It is necessary.
So then there's a third condition of ours, distinct from that of the one feeling joy and that of the one feeling pain.
Indeed, there is.
Come now, try hard to keep this in mind, for it makes no small difference in judging pleasure whether we remember this or not. Let's work through it briefly, if you're willing.
Tell me what you mean.
You know that nothing prevents someone who has chosen the life of thought from living in just this way.
You mean the life of neither feeling joy nor feeling pain?
Yes, it was said, in that comparison of lives, that the one who chose the life of understanding and thinking need feel no joy at all, great or small.
Yes, that was indeed said.
Then that condition would belong to him, and perhaps it's not at all strange if his is the most godlike of all lives.
It's certainly not likely that the gods feel joy, or its opposite either.
No, not likely at all. Either one would be unseemly for them. But we'll look into this further another time, if it's relevant, and credit it toward intellect's claim to second prize, if we can't credit it toward first prize. Now, the other form of pleasure, the one we said belongs to the soul itself, comes about entirely through memory.
How so?
We need to first take up what memory actually is, and it looks like we need to go back even further, to perception, if these matters are going to become clear to us in due course.
What do you mean?
Consider that, of the states our body undergoes each time, some are quenched in the body before reaching the soul, leaving it unaffected, while others pass through both and set up a kind of disturbance peculiar to each and shared by both.
Let that stand.
If we say that the soul fails to notice those that don't pass through both, but does notice those that do, would we be speaking most correctly?
Of course.
Now don't suppose for a moment that by failing to notice, I mean some coming into being of forgetting here, for forgetting is the departure of memory, and in the case we're now discussing, memory hasn't yet occurred. It would be absurd to speak of the loss of something that neither exists nor has yet come to be. Isn't that so?
Indeed.
Then just change the names.
Hold.
Instead of the soul failing to notice, when it remains unaffected by the body's disturbances, call what you're now calling forgetting by the name insensibility.
I understand.
And when the soul and body are jointly affected by one experience and jointly moved, if you name this movement perception, you wouldn't be speaking off the mark.
Very true.
So we now understand what we want to call perception.
Of course.
Then one would be right to call memory the preservation of perception, in my judgment at least.
Yes, rightly so.
But don't we say that recollection is different from memory?
Perhaps.
Isn't it this?
What?
When the soul, without the body, recovers within itself, as fully as it can, what it once experienced together with the body, that, we say, is when it recollects. Isn't that so?
Quite so.
And also when it has lost the memory of some perception or piece of learning, and then recovers this again within itself, by itself. All these cases, too, we call recollections and memories.
You're right.
The reason all this has been said is the following.
What is it?
So that we might grasp the pleasure of the soul, apart from the body, as clearly and distinctly as possible and desire along with it. For it's through these, it seems, that both are somehow made evident.
Let's move on then, Socrates, to what comes next.
It seems we must, in discussing the origin of pleasure and its whole form, examine a good many things. And now, even before that, it appears we must grasp what desire is and where it arises.
Then let's examine it, we'll lose nothing by it.
On the contrary, Prodarchus, we will lose something we'll lose, once we've found what we're now seeking, the puzzlement surrounding these very questions.
A fair rebuttal. Let's try to say what comes next.
Didn't we just say that hunger and thirst, and many other such things are desires?
Very much so.
What in the world do we have in view, that we call things so different by one name?
By Zeus, that's perhaps not easy to say, Socrates, but it must be said all the same.
Let's take it up again from the same starting point.
From where?
We say on each occasion that someone is thirsty.
Of course.
And this means he is being emptied.
Of course.
Is thirst then a desire?
Yes, a desire for drink.
For drink, or for the filling that comes with drink?
For the filling, I'd say.
So it seems that whichever of us is being emptied desires the opposite of what he's undergoing, being emptied. He longs to be filled.
Perfectly clear.
Well then, can someone who is being emptied for the first time somehow lay hold, whether by perception or by memory, of fullness, a thing he isn't experiencing now and never experienced before?
How could he?
And yet we say the one who desires, desires something.
Of course.
So he doesn't desire what he's undergoing, for he's thirsty and that's emptiness, while what he desires is fullness.
Yes.
Then something belonging to the thirsty man must somehow lay hold of fullness.
It must.
But the body can't, for it's being emptied.
Yes.
So it remains that the soul lays hold of the fullness, clearly by memory, for by what else could it lay hold of it?
By hardly anything else.
Do we now understand what follows from this argument?
What?
This argument tells us that desire doesn't arise in the body.
How so?
Because it shows that every living thing's effort is always directed against its own bodily condition.
Very much so.
And the impulse that leads toward the opposite of that condition surely reveals a memory of the opposite of what it's undergoing.
Quite so.
So by showing that it's memory that leads us toward the objects of our desire, the argument has revealed that the whole impulse, the desire, and indeed the very origin of every living thing, belong to the soul.
Perfectly right.
So the argument allows in no way that our body thirsts or hungers, or undergoes anything of that sort.
Very true.
Now let's notice something further about these same matters, for the argument seems to me to want to reveal to us some particular form of life in just these cases.
In which cases, and concerning what sort of life do you mean?
In being filled and being emptied, and everything that has to do with the preservation and destruction of living things, and whether any of us, finding himself in either of these, feels pain at one time and joy at another, according to the changes.
That's so.
What about when he's in between these two? Because of what he's suffering, he feels pain, but he remembers the pleasant things that would end his pain once they came about, and yet he isn't filled with them yet. What do we say then? Should we say he's in the middle of these two experiences, or not?
We should say that.
Is he in pain altogether, or feeling pleasure?
No, by Zeus. Rather, he's pained by a kind of double pain, in his body from the actual affliction, and in his soul from a longing tied to expectation.
What do you mean, Prodarchus, by this doubling of pain? Isn't it true that sometimes one of us, in a state of emptiness, stands in clear hope of being filled, while at other times he's without hope of it?
Very much so.
And don't you think that when a man hopes to be filled, the very remembering gives him pleasure, while at the same time being empty in that period, he feels pain?
That must be so.
So then a human being, and the other animals too, feels pain and pleasure at the same time?
It seems likely.
And what about when a person is without hope of achieving fulfillment while empty? Isn't it then that the double condition regarding pains arises, the one you just now noticed and thought was simply double?
Very true, Socrates.
Well then, let's put this consideration to use for these experiences.
What consideration?
Shall we say these pleasures and pains are true or false, or that some are true and others not?
But Socrates, how could pleasures or pains be false?
And how, Prodarchus, could fears be true or false, or expectations true or not, or opinions true or false?
Opinions, I'd grant you, perhaps, but not those other things.
What do you mean? We're likely stirring up a rather substantial argument.
True.
But we must examine whether this is relevant to what came before, son of that man.
Perhaps it is.
Then we must dismiss anything long-winded, or anything else said out of place.
Rightly said.
Tell me then, I'm continually amazed at the very same puzzles we just now set out. How do you put it? Are some pleasures false and others true, or not?
How could that be?
Neither in dreams, you say, nor waking, nor in madness or derangement. Is there ever anyone who seems to feel pleasure but doesn't feel it at all, or seems to feel pain but doesn't?
We've all assumed things stand just that way, Socrates.
Is that assumption correct, then? Or must we examine whether it's said rightly or not?
We must examine it, I'd say.
Let's mark out still more clearly what we just said about pleasure and opinion. There's such a thing as forming an opinion for us, isn't there?
Yes.
And feeling pleasure.
Yes.
And there's also something that is opined.
Of course.
And something by which the one who feels pleasure.
Certainly.
Now the one forming the opinion, whether he opines rightly or not, never loses the actual act of opining.
How could he?
And likewise the one feeling pleasure, whether rightly or not, clearly never loses the actual feeling of pleasure.
Yes, that's how it stands too.
So we must examine in what way opinion tends to become both false and true for us, while pleasure has only the true kind. Though the actual opining and the actual feeling of pleasure are allotted equally to both.
We must examine it.
Is it because falsity and truth attach themselves to opinion, so that it becomes, through this, not merely opinion but opinion of a certain quality? Is that what you say needs examining?
Yes.
And besides this, we must also agree whether, generally, some things have qualities while pleasure and pain are only what they are, without ever becoming qualified.
Clearly so.
But it's not at all hard to see that they too have qualities. We said long ago that pains and pleasures alike come in great and small, and in intense degrees.
Quite so.
And if badness attaches itself to one of these, Prodarchus, shall we say the opinion becomes bad in that way, and the pleasure bad too?
Well, what else, Socrates?
And what if rightness, or its opposite, attaches to one of them? Won't we call the opinion right if it has rightness, and the pleasure the same?
Necessarily.
And if what's opined turns out to be mistaken, must we agree the opinion, erring then, is not right, nor rightly opining?
How could it be?
But what if we observe that a pain or a pleasure is mistaken about the very thing it's pained or pleased over? Shall we attach to it the word right, or good, or any of the fine names?
That's not possible, if the pleasure will indeed be in error.
And yet it does seem that pleasure often arises in us not accompanied by right opinion, but by falsehood.
Of course, and in such a case, Socrates, we do call the opinion false, but no one would ever call the pleasure itself false.
You're eagerly defending pleasure's case just now, Protarchus.
Not at all. I'm only saying what I've heard said.
Does it make no difference to us, my friend, whether the pleasure comes with right opinion and knowledge, or with the falsehood and ignorance that often arise in each of us?
It's likely to make no small difference.
Then let's proceed to examine the difference between them.
Lead the way wherever seems best to you.
This is the way I'll lead.
Which way?
Opinion, we say, is sometimes false and sometimes true.
It is.
And often, as we were just saying, pleasure and pain follow along with these. True opinion and false opinion, I mean.
Quite so.
Now doesn't opinion, and the attempt to form opinions, arise for us on each occasion out of memory and perception?
Very much so.
Isn't it necessary that we're in something like this condition regarding these things?
Hold.
When someone sees things from a distance, not very clearly, wouldn't you say he often wants to judge what he's making out?
I'd say so.
Then wouldn't this same person next ask himself something like this?
What?
What in the world is that thing appearing to stand by the rock under some tree? Don't you think a person would say such things to himself, having glimpsed some such appearance?
Certainly.
And then after this, wouldn't such a person, as if answering himself, say that it's a man hitting on the truth?
Quite so.
But then again, misled, he might instead call the thing he's making out the work of some shepherds.
Very possibly.
And if someone is there with him, he'd stretch what he said to himself into speech, addressing it to the person present, the very same words, and so what we then called opinion has become an actual statement.
Of course.
But if he's alone, thinking this same thing to himself, he carries it around within him, sometimes for quite a while.
Certainly.
Well then, does what I think about this appear the same to you?
What's that?
It seems to me that at such a time, our soul resembles a kind of book.
How so?
Memory, coinciding with the perceptions, and whatever feelings cluster around these, seem to me to write words in our souls, as it were, at that moment. And when this experience writes what's true, true opinion results and true statements arising from it come about in us. But when the scribe within us writes something false, the opposite of the truth results.
That's quite how it seems to me too, and I accept what's been said in that way.
Then accept also another craftsman at work in our souls at that same time.
Which one?
A painter, who comes after the scribe of words and paints in the soul images of the things just spoken of.
But how and when do we say this one works?
Whenever someone, having drawn the opinions and statements from sight or some other perception away from the act of seeing itself, then in some way views within himself images of the things opined and stated. Isn't that something that happens in us?
Very much so.
So then the images of true opinions and statements are true, while those of false ones are false.
Absolutely.
If we've spoken rightly on this, let's examine one further point besides.
What point?
Whether this is something we must necessarily undergo regarding things that are and have happened, but not regarding things that are going to be.
No, the same holds for all times alike.
Now weren't the pleasures and pains that come through the soul itself said earlier to arise even before the pleasures and pains that come through the body, so that it turns out we can feel pleasure and pain in advance, regarding time yet to come.
Very true.
Then do the writings and paintings, which we said a little earlier come to be in us, concern only past and present time, and not the future.
Very much so.
Do you really mean that all these are hopes reaching toward time to come, and that we are, throughout our whole life, always full of hopes?
Absolutely.
Come then, answer me this as well, in addition to what's been said.
What is it?
A just man and a pious and good one, is he not altogether dear to the gods?
Of course.
And what about the unjust man and the wholly bad one? Isn't he the opposite of that man?
How could he not be?
And every human being, as we were just saying, is full of many hopes.
Of course.
And there are statements present in each of us, which we call hopes.
Yes.
And what's more, there are also the painted images. And a person often sees himself coming into abundant gold and many pleasures on account of it. Indeed, he sees himself painted in there too, rejoicing greatly over it.
Of course.
Shall we say, then, that for the good these painted scenes are, for the most part true, since they're dear to the gods, while for the wicked it's for the most part the opposite, or shall we not say that?
We certainly must say it.
But the wicked no less have pleasures painted within them too. Only these, presumably, are false.
Of course.
So the wicked, for the most part, delight in false pleasures, while good people delight in true ones.
What you say is quite inevitable.
So according to our present account, there are false pleasures in the souls of human beings, imitating the true ones but in a more ridiculous way, and pains likewise.
There are.
Now it was the case that anyone who forms an opinion at all always genuinely does form an opinion, even when it isn't about things that are, or have been, or will be.
Quite so.
And this, I think, is what produced false opinion then, and the forming of a false opinion. Is that right?
Yes.
Well then, mustn't we grant to pains, and pleasures the corresponding condition in their own case?
How?
That whoever feels pleasure at all, however and about whatever it may randomly be, always genuinely does feel pleasure, even though it isn't about things that are or have been, and often, perhaps most often, about things that will never even come to be.
This too must be so, Socrates.
Then wouldn't the same account hold for fears, and fits of anger, and all such things, that all of these too are sometimes false?
Quite so.
And what about it? Can we say bad and good opinions come to be otherwise than by being false?
In no other way.
Nor, I think, do we understand pleasures to be bad in any other way than by being false.
You've said exactly the opposite of the truth, Socrates. It's hardly the case that false pains and pleasures are especially bad. Rather, it's the ones mixed up with some other great and widespread badness.
Well, we'll talk shortly about the pains and pleasures that are bad because of badness, if we still think it worth doing. But the false ones, the many that exist in us and keep arising in a different way, those we need to discuss now, since we'll probably need that for our judgments.
Of course, if they really exist.
But they do exist, Prodarchus, in my view at least, and as long as that opinion stands with us, it obviously can't go untested.
Fair enough.
Then let's circle around this argument the way wrestlers do.
Let's go.
Now, if we remember, we said a little earlier that whenever the so-called desires are in us, the body and the soul are at that moment split apart and separated in their experiences.
We remember that was said before.
And wasn't it the soul that did the desiring the state opposite to what the body was in, while it was the body that produced the pain or some pleasure through its condition?
Yes, that's how it was.
Then work out what happens in these cases.
Go on.
It turns out that whenever this happens, pain and pleasure lie side by side, and our perceptions of them, opposite as they are, arise right next to each other, which is exactly what showed up just now.
So it appears.
And hasn't this also been said, and already agreed between us?
What's that?
That both of these, pain and pleasure, admit of more and less, and that they belong among the unlimited things.
It's been said, what of it?
So what means do we have of judging these correctly?
In what way and how?
If the aim of our judgment in cases like these is, each time, to determine which of them is greater than the other and which is smaller, and which is more intense and which more forceful, pain against pleasure, pain against pain, pleasure against pleasure.
Yes, that's the kind of thing they are, and that is indeed the aim of the judgment.
Well then, in sight, doesn't looking at sizes from far away and from close up hide the truth and make us form false opinions? And doesn't the very same thing happen with pains and pleasures?
Even more so, Socrates.
So now we've arrived at the opposite of what we said a moment ago.
What do you mean?
Earlier it was the opinions, true or false, that in becoming so, filled the pains and pleasures themselves with their own condition.
Very true.
But now it's the pains and pleasures themselves that, because they're each time viewed from far away or close up and set side by side with each other, appear, the pleasures, greater and more intense next to what is painful, and the pains, in turn, appear the opposite next to pleasures.
That's bound to happen, given all this.
So then, to whatever degree each of the two appears greater or smaller than it really is, if you cut away that apparent excess, which isn't real from each of them, you won't call that appearance itself correct, nor will you ever dare to call the resulting portion of the pleasure or pain right and true.
No, indeed not.
Next we'll look, if we approach it this way, for pleasures and pains that are false in a still deeper sense than these, both as they appear and as they exist in living creatures.
Which ones do you mean, and how?
It's been said many times that when the nature of each thing is being disturbed, by combinations and separations, fillings and emptyings, certain growths and wastings, pains and aches and sufferings, and everything that goes by such names result.
Yes, that's been said often.
And when a thing is settling back into its own nature, we agreed that this restoration is pleasure, as far as we ourselves are concerned.
Correct.
But what about when none of this is happening in our body at all?
And when would that ever happen, Socrates?
That question you're asking now is beside the point, Protarchus.
Why is that?
Because it doesn't stop me from asking you my own question again.
Which one?
If such a state didn't occur, Protarchus, I'll say, what would necessarily follow from that for us?
You mean with the body moved in neither direction?
That's it.
Well, this much is clear, Socrates, neither pleasure nor pain would ever arise in such a state.
Beautifully put, but I think what you mean is that one of these two must always be happening to us, as the wise men say, for everything is always flowing up and down.
Yes, that's what they say, and they don't seem to be talking nonsense.
How could they, being no fools themselves? But I want to slip out of the way of this argument as it comes bearing down. Here's how I plan to make my escape. Join me in it.
Tell me how.
Let's grant them all this, we'll say to these people. But you answer me. Is it always true that whatever happens to any living thing is felt by the thing it happens to, so that we never fail to notice ourselves growing or undergoing anything of that sort? Or is it quite the opposite?
Quite the opposite, surely. Nearly all such things escape our notice completely.
Then what we just said wasn't well put. That changes moving up and down produce pains and pleasures.
True enough.
It will be put better and less open to objection this way.
How?
That the great changes produce pains and pleasures in us, while the moderate and small ones produce neither of the two at all.
That's more correct than the other way, Socrates.
And if that's so, then the life we spoke of a moment ago comes back into view.
Which life?
The one we said was free of pain and without joys.
Quite true.
So from this, let's posit three lives for ourselves, one pleasant, one painful, and one neither. Or how would you put it?
I'd put it no other way. There are three lives.
Then not being in pain wouldn't be the same thing as feeling joy.
How could it be?
So whenever you hear someone say that the sweetest thing of all is to pass one's whole life without pain, what do you take such a person to mean?
It seems to me he's saying that not being in pain is pleasant.
Well, take any three things you like and set them down, using nicer names for them. Call one gold, another silver, and the third neither of these.
Done.
Now, could the one that is neither of the two ever become one of them, gold or silver?
How could it?
So the middle life, too, if it's called pleasant or painful, could never rightly be so judged. Not if one thinks it, nor if one says it, at least by the correct account.
How could it?
And yet, my friend, we do notice people saying this and thinking it.
Very much so.
Do they then also suppose they feel pleasure whenever they aren't in pain?
That's what they say, at any rate.
So they do suppose they feel pleasure then, otherwise they wouldn't say so.
It seems so.
But they hold a false opinion about feeling pleasure, if indeed the nature of not being in pain is distinct from that of feeling pleasure.
And it was distinct.
So shall we choose to hold that there are three states as just now, or only two, pain as an evil for human beings, and release from pains, which is itself a good, being called pleasant?
Why are we asking ourselves this now, Socrates? I don't follow.
Do you really not recognize the enemies of our friend Philebus here, Prodarchus?
Who do you mean?
People with quite a reputation for expertise in natural science, who say there is no such thing as pleasure at all.
What of it?
That all these things Philebus and his party now call pleasures are nothing but escapes from pain.
So are you advising us to believe them, Socrates, or what?
No, rather to make use of them the way one makes use of prophets, who divine not by skill but by a certain harshness of nature, not ignoble, that has come to hate the power of pleasure so intensely, and to regard it as nothing sound, that they take even pleasure's alluring charm to be sorcery rather than pleasure at all. You could make use of them in this way, after examining their other objections too. After that you'll hear what pleasures seem true to me, so that, having examined it from both accounts, we can weigh its power against the judgment.
Well said.
Let's pursue these people then as allies, following the trail of their harsh objection. I think what they mean is something like this, starting from somewhere further back. If we wanted to see the nature of any kind of thing, hardness, say, would we understand it better by looking at the hardest things or at things with only a trace of hardness? You must answer these harsh critics the way you'd answer me, Prodarchus.
Certainly, and I tell them, by looking at the things that are first in degree.
So if we wanted to see what nature the kind called pleasure has, we shouldn't look at the faintest pleasures, but at those said to be the most extreme and most intense.
Everyone would grant you that now.
And the pleasures readiest to hand, and also the greatest, are the bodily ones we keep mentioning, aren't they?
Of course.
Are they greater, and do they arise more in people who are sick and suffering than in people who are healthy? Let's be careful not to answer too hastily and stumble somewhere. We might well be tempted to say, in the healthy.
That's plausible.
Well, but don't the greatest pleasures come from the things that are preceded by the greatest desires?
That's true.
And don't people with fevers and those gripped by illnesses of that sort feel thirst and cold more, and everything the body normally undergoes, and are they not more caught up in deprivation, and don't they get greater pleasures when it's satisfied? Or shall we deny this is true?
What you've just said certainly does seem true.
So then, would we be right to say that if someone wanted to see the greatest pleasures, he shouldn't look toward health but toward sickness? Watch that you don't take me to be asking whether the very sick feel more pleasure than the healthy. Rather, think I'm looking for the size of pleasure and where its intensity occurs at each point. We need, I say, to grasp what nature it has, and what those who deny it exists at all are talking about.
Well, I think I'm following your argument.
You'll show it soon enough, Prodarchus. Answer me this. Do you see greater pleasures? I don't mean more numerous, but exceeding in intensity and degree, in a life of excess or in a life of self-control. Answer carefully.
I've understood what you mean, and I see a great difference. The self-controlled are held in check at every turn by that proverbial maxim, nothing too much, which they obey, but with the senseless and unrestrained, violent pleasure takes hold right up to madness and makes them notorious.
Well said. And if that's really so, it's clear that the greatest pleasures and the greatest pains, too, arise in some badness of soul and body, not in virtue.
Quite so.
So we need to pick out some of these and examine in just what way we meant they were the greatest.
That must be so.
Now look at the pleasures that come with disorders of this sort. What shape they take.
Which disorders do you mean?
The unseemly ones, the kind that people we called squeamish find utterly hateful.
Such as?
Take the relief people get from scratching an itch and anything like that which needs no other remedy. For heaven's sake, what should we call that feeling? Pleasure or pain?
It looks like some mixed sort of bad thing, Socrates.
I didn't bring this up for Philebus's sake. Without these pleasures, Prodarchus, and the ones that go with them, once we've examined them closely, we probably won't be able to settle the question we're now pursuing.
Then we'd better go after their relatives.
You mean the ones that share in this mixing?
Exactly.
Now, some mixtures occur in the body itself, within the body. Others belong to the soul alone, within the soul. And then we'll find further mixtures of pain and pleasure belonging to soul and body together, which are sometimes called pleasures and sometimes pains, depending on both together.
How so?
Whenever someone, in the process of settling into a state or being pulled apart from it, undergoes opposite affections at once, sometimes shivering and getting warm, sometimes being heated and then chilled, wanting, I think, to keep the one and be rid of the other. What's called a sweetness mixed with bitterness, when it's hard to shake off, it produces irritation and later a wild tension.
What you just said is quite true.
So some of these mixtures consist of equal pains and pleasures, others of one or the other in excess.
Of course.
Tell me about the ones where the pains outweigh the pleasures, the itching cases we just mentioned, and cases of tickling, when there's a boiling and inflammation inside, and the rubbing and scratching doesn't reach it, only stirs up the surface. Sometimes people bring these spots to the fire, or turn to the opposite, applying heat treatments, producing at times overwhelming pleasures, at other times the reverse, setting what's inside against what's outside, mixing pains with pleasures, and depending on which way the balance tips, they give relief either by forcibly dispersing what's compacted together or by compacting together what's dispersed. And so they set pains right alongside pleasures.
Very true.
And when, in cases like these, more pleasure gets mixed in, the small residue of pain causes a tingling and a mild irritation, while the much larger dose of pleasure poured in creates tension and sometimes makes people leap about, producing all sorts of colors, all sorts of postures, all sorts of gasping, and works up utter astonishment and cries devoid of sense.
Very much so.
And it makes a person say of himself, my friend, and makes others say of him, that he's practically dying of delight in these pleasures. And the more dissolute and senseless he happens to be, the more relentlessly he chases after them. He calls these the greatest pleasures, and reckons the one who lives immersed in them as much as possible to be the happiest of all.
You've laid out exactly, Socrates, what most people believe on all this.
Yes, concerning the pleasures found in the body's own common affections, blended from what's on the surface and what's within. But as for the cases where soul opposes body, pain set against pleasure and pleasure against pain, so that the two come together into one single blend, we went through those earlier. How, when a person is emptied out, he desires to be filled and rejoices in hoping, yet suffers pain while being emptied. We didn't call witnesses to that then, but now we say that when soul and body pull apart in all these countless cases, a single mixture of pain and pleasure comes about.
You're probably quite right.
There's still one mixture of pleasure and pain left for us.
Which one do you mean?
The one we said the soul itself often takes on, all by itself.
What exactly do we mean by that?
Anger, fear, longing, lamentation, love, jealousy, envy, and all such things. Don't you count these as pains belonging to the soul itself?
I do.
Then won't we find them also full of boundless pleasures? Or do we need reminding the case of rage and anger, the one who goads even a wise man into fury, though far sweeter than dripping honey? And the pleasures found in lamentation and longing, mixed in among the pains.
No, that's exactly how these things come about, and no other way.
And you remember watching tragedies, how people weep even as they enjoy themselves.
Of course.
And do you know that our state of soul at comedies also involves a mixture of pain and pleasure?
I don't quite follow that one.
It really isn't easy, Prodarchus, to grasp that particular experience in this case.
It doesn't seem so to me, at any rate.
Then let's take it up all the more precisely, since it's the murkier case, so that in other instances, too, one may find it easier to recognize a mixture of pain and pleasure.
Go on, then.
Take the term we just used, envy. Will you set it down as some pain of the soul, or how?
Yes, that.
But surely, the envious man will turn out to take pleasure in the misfortunes of his neighbors.
Very much so.
And ignorance is a bad thing, what we call a foolish condition.
Certainly.
Now from all this, see what nature laughter has.
Just tell me.
It's a kind of badness in some, named after a certain condition. And of all badness, It's the opposite state to what's written on the inscription at Delphi.
You mean know yourself, Socrates?
I do. The opposite of that would clearly be not knowing oneself at all, the thing the inscription warns against.
Certainly.
Now, Protarchus, try to cut this into three.
How do you mean, I doubt I can manage it?
So you're saying, I need to make this division now.
I am, and I'm asking you too, on top of saying so.
Isn't it necessary that those who don't know themselves fall into this condition in one of three ways?
How so?
First, regarding money, thinking oneself richer than one's actual wealth.
Many people, at any rate, have that condition.
And even more think themselves taller and better looking than they are, and superior in every bodily respect, beyond the truth of their actual state.
Quite so.
But the vast majority, I think, are mistaken about the third kind, the one concerning qualities of soul, thinking themselves better in virtue than they are, when they're not.
Very much so.
And among the virtues, isn't it wisdom that the crowd clings to hardest of all, full of quarrels and false pretensions to wisdom?
Of course.
One would be right to call all of this a bad condition.
Very much so.
Now we still need to split this in two, Protarchus, if we're going to see, in this childish envy, the strange mixture of pleasure and pain. How do we cut it in two, you ask? All those who hold this false opinion of themselves foolishly, as is true of every one of these, some necessarily have strength and power attached to them, others, I think, the opposite.
Necessarily.
Divide it that way, then. Those among them who are weak and unable to retaliate when laughed at call them ridiculous, and you'll speak the plain truth. But those who are capable of retaliating and strong call them frightening and hateful. You'll give the most accurate account of them for yourself. For ignorance in the strong is hateful and shameful, harmful to their neighbors, both itself and any likenesses of it, while the weak sort of ignorance has been allotted the rank and nature of the ridiculous.
Quite right, but I still don't see clearly the mixture of pleasures and pains in these cases.
Then take up first the power of envy.
Just tell me.
There's some unjust pain and some pleasure too.
That must be so.
Now, taking pleasure in the misfortunes of enemies is neither unjust nor a mark of envy.
Certainly not.
But seeing the misfortunes of friends and not being pained, but taking pleasure instead, isn't that unjust?
Of course it is.
And didn't we say ignorance is bad for everyone?
Rightly so.
So the false pretension to wisdom or beauty in our friends and all the rest we just went through occurring, we said in three kinds ridiculous when weak, hateful when powerful. Shall we say or not say what I said just now, that this condition in friends when it's harmless to others is ridiculous?
Quite so.
And don't we agree that it's a bad thing, being ignorance?
Very much so.
And do we feel pleasure or pain when we laugh at it?
Clearly pleasure.
And didn't we say that pleasure at the misfortunes of friends is the work of envy?
It must be.
So our argument tells us that in laughing at the ridiculous traits of our friends by mixing pleasure with envy, we're mixing pleasure with pain. Since we agreed long ago that envy is a pain of the soul, and laughing is a pleasure, and the two occur together on these occasions.
True.
So our argument now reveals that in laments, in tragedies and comedies, not only on stage, but in the whole tragedy and comedy of life, pains are mixed together with pleasures, and in countless other cases too.
It's impossible not to agree with this, Socrates, even for someone bent on arguing the opposite.
Now we proposed anger, longing, lamentation, fear, love, jealousy, and envy, and all such things, as cases where we said we'd find the very mixtures we've now often discussed. Isn't that so?
Yes.
Then we understand that everything we just went through applies to lamentation, envy, and anger.
Of course, we understand.
And there's still much left over.
A great deal, indeed.
Why do you suppose I singled out the mixture in comedy to show you? Wasn't it to give you confidence, since it's easy to display the blend in fears, in love, and the rest, so that once you've grasped this point for yourself, you'd let me off from having to go through those other cases and drawing things out, and simply accept this. That body without soul, soul without body, and the two together are full in their experiences of pleasure blended with pain. So tell me now, will you let me off, or will you keep me here till midnight? I think I can get off with saying just a little more. I'll be willing to give you an account of all this tomorrow. For now, I want to move on to what remains, toward the judgment Philebus is pressing us for.
Well said, Socrates, but go through what's left in whatever way you please.
Then naturally, after the mixed pleasures, by some necessity we should move on in turn to the unmixed ones.
Well put.
Let me try to shift ground and explain these to you. As for those who claim that every pleasure is simply a cessation of pain, I'm not at all convinced, rather, as I said. I'm using them as witnesses that some things that seem to be pleasures are not pleasures at all, while certain other things appear great and numerous at once, though they are really jumbled together with pains, and with the relief of the worst distresses of body and soul.
And which pleasures, Socrates, would one correctly take to be true?
Those connected with what are called beautiful colors, with shapes, with most smells, with sounds, and with anything whose lack goes unnoticed and unfelt while its fulfillment is felt and pleasant, arriving pure of any pain.
How do you mean this, Socrates?
What I'm saying isn't obvious right away, but let's try to make it clear. I'm not now trying to speak of the beauty of shapes in the sense the many would assume living things, say, or paintings of them, but something straight, our argument says, and round, and the plain and solid figures produced from these by the lathe, and those made by rulers and set squares, if you follow me. These, I claim, are not beautiful relative to something, as other things are, but are by nature always beautiful in themselves, and possess pleasures of their own, in no way like the pleasure of scratching an itch. And colors of this same kind are beautiful too, and have their own pleasures. Do we follow this or not?
I'm trying to, Socrates, but you try to put it still more clearly.
I mean the smooth, clear sounds that give off one pure note, beautiful not in relation to something else but in themselves, with pleasures native to them that follow along.
Yes, that too exists.
The class of pleasures connected with smells is a less divine kind than these, but the fact that no necessary pains are mixed in with them, wherever and in whatever this occurs for us, I count as the exact counterpart of the other case. So, if you follow, these are the two kinds of pleasure we're speaking of.
I follow.
Now then, let's add to these the pleasures connected with learning. If indeed we think these have no hungers, no pains arising at the start from a hunger for learning.
Yes, I agree with that.
But what about this? When people who have been filled with learning later suffer losses through forgetting, do you see any pains in that?
Not by nature, no, only in certain calculations about the experience, whenever someone, deprived of it, is pained by the need for it.
But right now, my good man, we're tracing only the natural experiences themselves, apart from any calculation.
Then you're right that forgetting happens to us in matters of learning every time without pain.
So these pleasures of learning must be said to be unmixed with pain, and belong not to the many at all, but to very few.
How could one not say so?
Now that we've reasonably distinguished the pure pleasures from those that could rightly be called nearly impure, let's add to our account that the violent pleasures involve excess, while the others involve the opposite. Measure, and let's set down that those admitting of the great and the violent, occurring often or seldom, belong to that class of the unlimited which runs, more or less, through body and soul alike, while the others belong to the class of the measured.
Perfectly right, Socrates.
There's still one more thing about them to examine after this.
What's that?
What should we say is closer to truth, the pure and unmixed, or the intense, the abundant, the great, the vehement?
What are you really asking me, Socrates, and why?
So as to leave nothing out, Prodarchus, in testing pleasure and knowledge fully, whether each of them has a pure part and an impure part, so that each may come to judgment in its purest form, making the verdict easier for me, for you, and for all of us here.
Quite right.
Come then, let's think this way about all the kinds we call pure. Let's pick out one of them first and examine it.
Which shall we pick?
Let's look first at the kind called white, if you like.
By all means.
Then what would purity in white be, and what would count as it? Is it the largest and most abundant amount, or the most unmixed, in which no trace whatever of any other color is present?
Clearly the most unadulterated.
Right, so won't we say, Prodarchus, that this is the truest white, and at the same time the most beautiful of all whites, not the most abundant or the greatest?
Quite right.
So if we say that a small amount of pure white is whiter, and at the same time more beautiful and truer than a large amount mixed with other things, we'll be speaking entirely correctly.
Entirely correctly indeed.
Well then, surely we won't need many such examples for our account of pleasure. It's enough to grasp straight away from this that any pleasure whatever, small or great, will be more pleasant, truer, and more beautiful once purified of pain.
Absolutely, and this example is sufficient.
Now what about this? Haven't we heard it said of pleasure that it's always a coming into being, and that pleasure has no being at all? Some clever people try to convey this very point to us, and we owe them thanks.
How so?
I'll work this out for you by asking further questions, dear Prodarchus.
Just speak and ask.
There are two things, one existing in itself, the other always reaching after something else.
What are these two, and what do you mean?
The one is always by nature the most august, the other falls short of it.
Say it still more clearly.
We've observed beautiful and good boys, and along with them their courageous lovers.
Certainly.
Now look for two other things resembling these two, running through everything we say exists.
Should I say it a third time? Speak more clearly, Socrates, about what you mean.
Nothing elaborate, Prodarchus, our argument is just teasing us. It's saying that of the things that exist, one is always for the sake of something, while the other that for whose sake the first is always coming to be, is what it's always coming to be for the sake of.
I barely followed that, and only because you said it so many times.
Perhaps, my boy, we'll understand better as the argument goes on.
Of course.
Let's take up these two further things.
What things?
One coming to be of all things, the other being as a separate thing.
I accept these two from you being and coming to be.
Quite right. Now which of these is for the sake of which? Shall we say coming to be is for the sake of being, or being for the sake of coming to be?
Are you now asking whether the thing called being is what it is for the sake of coming to be?
So it seems.
In the god's name, are you asking me something like this? Tell me, Prodarchus, do you say shipbuilding happens for the sake of ships, or ships for the sake of shipbuilding, and all such cases?
That's exactly what I mean, Prodarchus.
Then why didn't you answer yourself, Socrates?
No particular reason, but you should share in the argument too.
By all means.
Well, I say that drugs and all instruments and all materials are provided for the sake of coming to be in every case, and that each particular coming to be occurs for the sake of some particular being, and that coming to be as a whole occurs for the sake of being as a whole.
Perfectly clear.
So pleasure too, if indeed it's a coming to be, must necessarily come to be for the sake of some being.
Of course.
And surely that for whose sake a thing that comes to be for something always comes to be belongs to the portion of the good, while what comes to be for the sake of something else must be placed, my friend, in a different portion.
Absolutely necessary.
So if pleasure really is a coming to be, won't we be right to place it in a portion other than the good?
Perfectly right.
So just as I said at the start of this argument, we owe thanks to the one who pointed out that pleasure is a coming to be, and has no being whatsoever, for clearly he's laughing at those who claim pleasure is a good.
He certainly is.
And this same person will also laugh at all those who find their fulfillment in the various comings to be.
What do you mean, and which people?
I mean those who, curing hunger or thirst or anything of that sort that coming to be cures, rejoice in the coming to be as though it were pleasure itself, and say they wouldn't choose to live without thirsting and hungering and experiencing all the other things that follow upon such states.
They do seem to say that, at least.
And wouldn't we all say that the opposite of coming to be is perishing?
Necessarily.
So anyone choosing this would be choosing perishing and coming to be, not that third life in which one neither rejoices nor suffers pain, but which allows for thinking in the purest way possible.
A great deal of absurdity results, it seems, Socrates, if one sets down pleasure as our good.
A great deal indeed, since we can still put it this way too.
Hello.
Isn't it absurd that nothing is good or beautiful in bodies, or in most other things except in the soul, and their only pleasure while courage, moderation, understanding, and all the other goods the soul possesses count as nothing of the kind? And beyond this, that the person not rejoicing but in pain must be forced to admit he's bad whenever he's in pain, even if he's the best of all people, while the one who rejoices, the more he rejoices, the more he's supposed to excel in virtue, just in that moment of rejoicing.
All this, Socrates, is as absurd as it could possibly be.
So let's not try to conduct every possible scrutiny of pleasure while appearing to spare understanding and knowledge entirely. Instead, let's nobly knock on both of them all over, to see if either has anything unsound in it, so that once we've seen what is purest by nature in each, we can use that for the common judgment between them and the truest parts of pleasure.
Right.
Now I think one part of our knowledge is the craftsman's kind, concerned with the arts, and another part concerns education and nurture. Isn't that so?
Yes.
Let's first consider, in the case of the manual arts, whether one part of them holds more to knowledge and another less, and whether we should regard some as the purest and others as more impure.
Yes, we should.
Then we must distinguish the leading ones among them, each separately.
Which ones and how?
For instance, if one were to separate arithmetic, measurement, and weighing out from all the other arts, what's left over from each would, so to speak, be trivial.
Trivial indeed.
What's left after that would be guesswork, training the senses through experience and a certain practice skill, drawing on the powers of estimation that many people call arts, powers whose strength has been built up through practice and effort.
That's exactly right.
Now music, to begin with, is full of this, isn't it? Tuning its harmonies not by measurement but by a trained guess, and the whole art of flute playing along with it, hunting for the right pitch of each string by estimation, so that it has a great deal of guesswork mixed in and only a small amount of certainty.
Very true.
And we'll find medicine, farming, piloting, and generalship the same way.